Very happy to be here. And I am giving the advance, I'll say, the second lecture on quantum field theory. And so the purpose of this lecture, as far as I've been asked, is to present some the tools and the way to quantize gauge theories and the modern theories of which are used in the in high energy physics, and then to ask for more advanced questions. So this lecture, I think, will be, I will try to be not too technical, but to introduce you to the basic ideas and mathematical tools and physical ideas which are behind the quantization of gauge theories. But I won't discuss most of the physics of gauge theories to describe the actual world. So I think this will be the purpose of the lecture by Michael Peskin next month. So what I intend to do is to divide my lecture in three parts. So the first part will be about, let us put it here. Mostly it will be an introduction to the path integral formalism. And its extensions, which are mainly dealing with field instead of particle, of non-relativistic particle. I understand that you have already had an introduction to what the path integral method is to quantize non-relativistic system. So I assume that you have already an idea what it's about, and I will start from this point to discuss the quantization of fields. Quantum, of course. Okay, so then the second part of the lecture will be about one of the most important aspect, conceptual aspect of quantum field theory, which is the idea of renormalization. I think you have heard about the idea of what renormalization is about in statistical mechanics and in the studies of, for instance, critical phenomena or statistical mechanical systems, either classical or quantum, where there are large correlation lengths. But the idea of renormalization was first, in fact, developed in the framework of high energy physics and then adapted by several people, but mostly Ken Wilson to and Leo Kadanoff, of course, to the study of critical phenomena. And then it went back to high energy physics and gave a new viewpoint on what high energy physics and quantum field theory is about. So I will discuss renormalization theory, mostly in the framework of path integral formalism and on a simple quantum field theory. And then I will discuss in more detail the quantization of gauge theories. Gauge theories, both abelian and non-abelian. In the lecture of David Tong, I think you have seen in some great details how one quantizes quantum electrodynamics in the framework of canonical quantization using Hilbert space formalism and operators and states. And I will do that both for electrodynamics and for non-abelian gauge theories in the framework of the path integral formalism and try to give a bit of the idea of what is the connection between the two. Okay. So now let's start with the path integral formalism. So you have seen, let us remind it here, that if you consider a particle which is a one-dimensional particle, okay, with the Hamiltonian, which is the usual Hamiltonian, p squared over 2m, that's kinetic energy, plus some potential, external potential, which may be, for instance, an harmonic potential for the harmonic oscillator, then you can represent the evolution operator, the matrix element of the evolution operator. So remember that the evolution operator is just the exponential of t over I h bar times Hamiltonian. That's the evolution operator. And it describes, in fact, just the evolution in time of the state of the wave function of the systems. Namely, in the Schrödinger pictures, if you start from a wave function psi of q in at time t equals 0, then psi of q at time t is given by u of t applied to psi 0. So let us write the state just by a vector. So, okay, so that's in the Schrödinger picture. Okay. And okay. And you have seen that you can represent by a path integral, so a sum over histories of the particle, the matrix element of this particle. So if you consider that you have a particle with which at time 0 starts from a position, let us call it q initial, and ends up at time t at some position q final. And you want to compute the amplitude, the probability amplitude, the quantum probability amplitude to for the particle to propagate from this point to this point. Okay, so you want to estimate this amplitude, and this amplitude corresponds to a matrix element of this evolution operator. And in the Schrödinger picture, this is just the matrix element between the final state of the system, of the particle, the initial states, and the evolution operator. So that it is this matrix element. So that's in the Schrödinger picture. In the Heisenberg picture, you can write this in a more compact way because you can write this as a scalar product between two states, the states of the particle which is located at qi at instant 0, at time 0, and the state of the particle which is at qf at time tf. But in any case, this is represented as a sum over histories, q of s, with exponential I over h bar times the action of this trajectory. And you sum over all possible trajectories, which goes from q high to qf. So you sum over all possible trajectories with, of course, the constraint that the q at time 0 is q high, and q at time t is qf. And S is just a classical action, the classical action of the particle. So the action, let us write it here. The action is S of the particle is the integral from 0 to time t of the Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian is m over 2. Q dot squared minus V of Q. So this is the action. Okay, so that's the basic idea behind the path integral formalism. So now the first things I want to discuss about the path integral formalism is what happens if you are doing quantum thermodynamics. So instead of studying the evolution in time of these systems, I will be interested into computing this system in equilibrium with some thermostat, so some larger system. So it is characterized by some temperature T. So instead of studying a single state of a quantum system, I am interested in what is the probability distribution on quantum states. And you know that when you have a system which is in a statistical state, so you know some information about it. For instance, here you know what is the temperature for this particle. This particle moves, but it's in contact with some larger system, so you know only what the temperature of the system is. You know that, so you know you have some statistical information of your system. You know that the properties of the system are described by what is called a density metric. A density matrix. Okay. And the density matrix is just, in that case, since we are in a system in equilibrium with some thermostat, the density matrix is just given by the Gibbs states, by the Gibbs states of the systems. So the density matrix is just, there is a normalization factor that I will call Z, times it is the exponential of minus beta times the Hamiltonian of the systems, where beta is the Boltzmann factor. It's just 1 over the Boltzmann constant times the temperature. Okay, and this basically gives you, it tells you that if the system is in an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, so in an energy eigenstate with an energy E, the probability for the particle to be in this eigenstate, the classical probability in the statistical sense, is proportional to exponential of minus the energy divided by the temperature. So it's just the standard probabilities in statistical physics. Okay? And it has been shown by Landau and Van Feynman and by many people, but that this density matrix describes, in fact, the statistical properties of the quantum system. Okay. And what you see is that this density, and of course, then Z, this normalization factor, is just here to make the sum of the probabilities to be equal to 1. So basically, Z is given by the trace of exponential of minus beta H. Okay, and that's in order for this density matrix. Let us call this density matrix rho of beta. It depends on the temperature. It's just here in order for the trace of rho of beta to be equal to 1. Okay, and that's necessarily because this density matrix element should correspond to probabilities, and therefore, when you are interested in what is the average value of some observable of the system, take an observable H of the system. Variable A, this is an operator, of course, an operator of the systems. And you are interested into what is the average value of A at temperature beta. That's the average temperature. And this is given just by the trace, in the sense of operator, of rho beta times the operator A. So that's the trace of a product of two operators, the observable and the density matrix. And that's a positive number. And of course, you need that the average of the unit operator, the identity operator, has to be 1. The sum of probabilities has to be 1. And this defines Z. And this function Z is called the partition function. Of the system. So I hope this is familiar for most of you. If you have any questions, please ask. So the main property, so something very interesting about this density matrix formalism is that this exponential of minus beta H looks very much like the formula for the evolution operator, because the evolution operator is the exponential of also some phase times the Hamiltonian. So here there is an I, while here there is a minus beta. So the only difference is here that there is a times divided by I, and here there is beta. But mathematically, it's the same kind of object. Yes. Yeah. So that's the starting point for a very interesting analogy, which is an analogy between quantum physics, so quantum mechanics, and statistical mechanics. That's not an equivalence, but that's an analogy. And the analogy is the following. Consider this general evolution operator U of t, which is exponential of t over I times h bar times the Hamiltonian of the systems. And consider it, consider this operator. That's an operator which is a function of time, considering it as a function of time when time is a complex variable. So, of course, in quantum physics, you are interested in how the system evolves for real time. But now, forget about the physics and just ask, what happened to this object considered as an operator when time becomes imaginary or complex? And what you see very easily is that if the imaginary part of time is negative, or the also in the lower half plane, this U of t is defined as an operator because it's bounded. It's a bounded operator. It has a norm. The norm of any state, if you multiplied a state of the system, so wave function by U, you get another vector which has a norm less or equal to the first vector in general. So it's an operator which is bounded in the space of all observable acting on the system. So it belongs to the observable of the systems. While if the imaginary part of time is positive, then you have some exponential factor here which may become very, very large if you consider a state with a very large energy. So very excited state has a probability which we has a matrix element which are exponential of t times ih times the energy of the system. And if the energy is very large, and if the time has a positive imaginary part, this gives an exponential of something which is some very large positive number. So it gives very, very large probabilities. And the operator is not bounded if the spectrum is not bounded from above. So in general, this region is forbidden. So as a function of t, the evolution operator is defined only in the lower half plane. Okay? And you see that something happens, something interesting happens when the time is purely imaginary, but with minus a negative imaginary part. So I write t equal minus I times some tau. Because so if you start from a point here and you look at what's happening to the evolution operator in this case. Because in that case, U of t becomes simply exponential of minus tau over h bar times the Hamiltonian. Okay? So this is exactly the same form than the operator which is proportional to the density, which gives the density matrix. Okay? And the analogy is that this tau is equal to h bar times the factor beta, so it's h bar divided by kbt. So that's a mathematical equivalence. But you see that looking at the system at imaginary time is equivalent to looking at the same system, the same quantum system, in thermal equilibrium with the temperature T. Okay, so the same mathematics describes the evolution of a quantum system in real time and the statistical properties of this system in equilibrium, this quantum system in equilibrium. Yes?
Do we worry about the normalization on our time evolution operator when time is imaginary?
Well, I won't because I want to. I will be considering how those operators act in the space of states of the systems. So I will be interested in this operator as one of the observables of the systems. And when you are doing quantum mechanics at a slightly more mathematically involved model level than what we are doing here, you have to consider the space of operators acting on the system. This space forms an algebra. It's an operator algebra. It's an algebra of the observable of the system. And in order to have a mathematical theory of quantum system which is consistent, this algebra of operator has to have a norm on it. So the operator has to be bounded in the sense of the norm of operator.
Right.
So that's important for the consistency of quantum mechanics.
Right, but that's not exactly what I was meaning. Like that we hear the probability is now allowed to be, that total probability is now allowed to be less than one.
No, and the norm, what's important for this operator to be bounded is that a bounded operator is the following object. Bounded operator is an operator A or O, let us say, so that if I take If I take O psi and I apply, I mean, this is a new operator, but it's not a wave function. It can be something with a different norm. This is not an Hermitian.
Not self-adjoint.
All what you need is that the norm of psi prime has to be less than or equal to some constant of the norm of psi squared for any psi. That's the definition of the bounded operator. And basically, this constant is a norm. This is what is called the norm in the space. And it's important to define consistently. To justify all what the calculation I will be doing, you have to consider operators which are norms, so therefore which lives in this space. Okay? Okay. So, once I've done that, I can ask the following question. And of course, you see that Z is just, the partition function is just the trace of this U of minus I tau. From this formula. Okay? So, now the question is, can we generalize the formula which gives this matrix element of this evolution operator for imaginary time? So what becomes the path integral at imaginary time? Okay. So now that we have defined what it is, you can play and a little bit. And well, you can do the calculation in a detailed way by using the same method used to derive what the path integral is, namely cutting this time interval in terms of tiny intervals and writing evolution operator for infinitesimally small time. You can do the same trick here. But you can also just, in a bit naive way, take the formula for the path integral and rotate, make this operation, change time into an imaginary time by this operation. Multiply the time by I. So, oh, by the way, this operation going from real time to imaginary time is often referred in the physics literature as what is called the Vick rotation. So it's a Vick rotation in the complex time plane. So it's a name for this operation. Yes?
If you were to divide up the imaginary
yes.
time into 12 bits, what kind of physical interpretation would that have?
No,
have
no physical interpretation. It's just a mathematical. There will be a mathematical physical interpretation once we review the system as a statistical mechanical system. But I will discuss that a bit later. Okay, so let us just be very, very naive and make this transformation in the path integral. So now, in the path integral, what's happening? Q of t is becoming of q of tau. So now, what's happening to the time derivative of t? I've changed t into minus I tau, so the time derivative becomes I times derivative of q considered as a function of tau. Okay? Now, what's beginning to the integral of a time? The integral of a time is becoming, of course, the minus I times an integral of a tau. Okay? So the action is becoming, there is a minus I factor. This term becomes minus q squared, and this term doesn't change. That function is B. So we get an I times, you get finally an I times so now, once you have done that, so you get an I factor instead of an action, which is the action becomes what is called an union action. Union action. So the action becomes I times integral d tau on about q dot square plus d q. So that's what this action becomes by this operation. And now, of course, we have, of course, to specify what we mean by the initial and the final condition in Euclidean time, in imaginary time. Okay. But we are interested in computing the partition function. So what is the trace? The trace means that we are taking the sum over diagonal element of the evolution operator. So the trace means that we take the sum over diagonal element, and the sum over diagonal element means that we integrate over all position eigenstate of the systems. So that's what becomes the trace, the trace. Okay. So you see here that the trace becomes an integral over diagonal element of this evolution operator at imaginary time. Okay. And so you see that you are interested in the evolution matrix element of the evolution operator starting from a given point and ending at the same point. So we are interested in a sum of histories at imaginary time which are periodic in this imaginary time. So we are interested, in fact, this becomes just then a functional integral of a path integral of a trajectory depending on imaginary time, with just a condition that the trajectory are periodic, namely that q of tau is equal of q of tau plus, I'm sorry, I will call this sigma. Because I have a tau here which is fixed, so let me call the imaginary part of time sigma. So it's a running coordinate like S, and this becomes like I've just the condition that those trajectories are periodic in imaginary time with a period which is given by this factor which is related to the temperature of the system. Okay. So I'm summing of periodic histories in imaginary time with a factor which is exponential of And here I have an I factor. Here I have an I factor over h bar. So what I get is a minus 1 over h bar times something which we'll call the Euclidean action of q of the trajectory. So I will put an e here. And this is what I called the Euclidean action associated to the trajectory q of c. OK, so the I factor here, which comes from performing a Vic rotation on the real-time action, is taken out of the definition of what I call the Euclidean action, or the imaginary time action, so that this I combines with this I to get a minus 1 factor. Okay. So once we have done this, I did that in a bit of a lengthy and careful way, we end up with a path integral representation of the partition function of the system at temperature beta. And it's a sum of a periodic histories of the system. Okay, with a period which is related, which is proportional to 1 over the temperature, and with an action which is now the sum of the kinetic energy and the potential energy for the system. So it's like an Hamiltonian, a classical Hamiltonian, instead of a classical Lagrangian. So it's the integral of a classical Hamiltonian instead of being the integral of the classical Lagrangian, you see? Okay. So that's what became, that's what the path integral became when going to imaginary time. Okay. Yes?
Why is the period of this system equal to h bar beta?
Oh, simply because of this analogy, I am interested in computing the partition function, which is originally the trace of exponential minus beta h, and I identified this with the evolution operator for the same system with a time which is imaginary. So tau over h bar here, where this is imaginary part of time, is identified with beta.
Yeah, but my point is, why is it that the period is exactly h bar beta?
Because t over h bar is equal to beta. This factor here, I identify with this
factor. Yeah, but the point is the tau is a variable, right? The tau is a variable.
No,
variable.
No. Tau, no. Now c the time variable. Sorry, that's it. Okay. I want to represent by a path integral the partition function of a system at temperature given by this Boltzmann factor of beta, which is 1 over k times. So I remark that this evolution this operator here can be written as the evolution of this operator of the same system with an imaginary time t equals minus I times tau, which is tau given by this relation. Now I write the path, I consult the path integral for this system at imaginary time, going from time 0 to time tau, and then closing back in time, in imaginary time, because I take the trace. And that's why there is relation. Okay. So once I've done that, you see that
I see that the path integral formalism can be used to do statistical mechanics on a quantum system, which is something which is very useful, for instance, in high energy physics, when you are interested in the properties of system at finite temperature, for instance, when you are studying the properties of ions in heavy ion collision, you construct for some time a system of particles one hopes to be able to construct, to build or to obtain a quark gluon plasma at a finite, very high temperature. So it's very, this formalism is useful to study quantum system, quantum field system, theory systems at finite temperature. It's also very, of course, very, very useful in condensed matter, because in condensed matter, you often have quantum systems, spins, electrons, atoms, at finite temperature, in equilibrium or out of equilibrium. But that's, okay. So this formalism is very useful in physics. Okay. Now, but now I want to discuss a little bit why this is related to statistical mechanics in another sense. So let us, where did I put my, here it is. Yes?
There are some systems, like systems of spins
yes.
that can have negative temperature. So would this not work?
This will not work because I'm always studying with the system at equilibrium. So it is at equilibrium with a finite temperature. So system with a negative temperature, a system will have excited points of atoms or spins. If you excite systems, you send a pulse of microwaves or energy, so that the excited states are more populated than the low energy states. So then you can say that it's a system at negative temperature, but of course it's an out of equilibrium system. So, and here I'm still in the framework of equilibrium thermodynamics. So that's very important. At equilibrium, the temperature has to increase. The system must have a finite entropy.
Okay. You say it has to be at a finite temperature, but
only for zero temperature.
Hmm?
Or zero.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how you could fail to meet that condition.
No, you can't feel at equilibrium. That's
okay.
The definition that should come from the fact that the system is at finite. Definition of temperature. System out of equilibrium is something very, very delicate. Often in complicated systems, you have different temperatures for different parts of the degrees of freedom of the system. Okay, so once we have done that, now let us make two remarks. First, why do I call this Euclidean action? For a very simple reason. That's because when this is real time, and I made this change of variables t equal minus I tau. So this part, this coordinate, this time coordinate is imaginary time. So, and you may ask what's happening to a relativistic system. So this is a system which is non-relativistic. Now, what's happening if you were considering a relativistic system and making the same kind of transformation? So for a relativistic systems, classical relativistic systems, I'm not doing quantum field theory. Okay, I know that I have to be in the framework of relativity theory. So I have the element, I'm in the Minkowski metric, and the element of length in the Minkowski metric, I will use this convention. All along my course, beware, I will be using the conventions as the signature of the metric is minus plus plus plus, typically, in four-dimensional space. So I understand that it's not the convention which has been used by David Tong, or which the not the one which is used in several books of high-energy physics. But it's convenient for what I will be doing. Pardon?
Yeah, of course, I'm sure that
Leo Kanner, of course. It's okay, so I'm using this convention. Okay. So now, if you are doing this operation, you see immediately that the element of length becomes ds squared equal d tau squared plus dx squared. So the signature of the metric is plus, plus, plus. And this becomes just the Euclidean distance in ordinary distance in a space, which is a space with d dimension, here d equal 4, for instance. Okay. So this time, when time becomes imaginary, it can be interpreted as the fourth real dimensional space. You have a space which is Euclidean. You have no time anymore. And you are doing interested in what's happening in Euclidean flat space. So hence the name Euclidean action. And hence the name, this parameter tau, which is called imaginary time, is often called Euclidean time for exactly the same reason. So by this operation, you see, I've transformed quantum mechanical systems in real time into a quantum mechanical systems in Euclidean time, if you want. Okay. So now, the second remark is then, think a little bit more about what this system represents if you consider that sigma is now a coordinate of space instead of being imaginary time. Okay? And for that, you can, for instance, start again from this system and imagine that, for instance, V is a harmonic oscillator, for instance. Harmonic oscillator. If you are considering the harmonic oscillator, then it means simply that V is equal to the V of Q is equal to M over 2, the frequency of oscillator, times Q squared. So the potential is of degree 2 in Q squared. Okay. So we have a sum, you have a term which is the derivative of Q squared plus a term which is proportional to Q squared. Okay. Now, remember that in order to define the proper way the path integral for maximum, you have to discretize time. So discretize again, Euclidean time. So for instance, imagine that your Euclidean time, tau, instead of being a continuous variables, has some element of volume, element of time epsilon, and that therefore that time tau is epsilon times some I being some an integer, and relabel q of tau as qi, the position of the systems at the time interval I. Okay, and then rewrite what this Euclidean action would be once you have discretized time. So the Euclidean action becomes, something very simple. It becomes, well, this becomes an epsilon times sum over I. The sum over the integral over times become an epsilon times the sum over the time steps. This becomes an M over 2. Qi plus 1 minus Qi divided by epsilon squared. Because you replace the time derivative by a finite difference time. And this becomes simply plus m over 2 omega squared Qi squared. OK? This is the frequency, the frequency of the oscillator. It's not a frequency in time, it's just a parameter. Let us call it omega naught, for instance, in order to be sure that it's not a frequency. Okay? So then you have rewritten the partition function for the harmonic oscillator in the quantum harmonic oscillator as a sum over configuration, you know, of a systems where at each time interval high, you have a Q high, a real variables, Q high, and you have the exponential of something which is minus 1 over h bar. You can view this at like 1 over the temperature, some new temperature for these systems, times something which is called the energy of the system. So you can rewrite this as a sum over configurations of the systems, which is Q high, of exponential minus 1 over h bar times some energy of the system Q high. And the energy is given by this. So this is analogous to the energy of the system. And this energy is contains two terms. There is a local term here, which is proportional to the distance to the Q high square. So you can view this Q high, you can view the Q high as a coordinate of some classical oscillator. So you have a system of classical oscillator. Now I have classical oscillators at each point on this line. You have an energy which tells you whether that the oscillator oscillates like that. Okay? And then you have a coupling between neighbors. Because it's these terms tell you that if two oscillators at two neighboring points, I and I plus 1, are excited together, it doesn't cost energy. But if those two oscillators are coupled in different directions, this costs you energy. So you have a system of classical oscillators on a line and coupled between neighbors. Okay? So this becomes the partition function for a classical system of oscillators in one-dimensional space. So this is a classical chain of oscillators in one dimension. So you see that there is an equivalence between the quantum harmonic oscillator on one point. So you have just one quantum oscillator at one quantum oscillator. Just you have. And a classical chain of oscillators. So an extended system of classical oscillators. So studying a classical system, a classical chain of oscillators, is, for some of the properties, equivalent to study the quantum properties of one single harmonic oscillator. Yes?
Interpreting a quantum particle as a wave?
Pardon?
Does this amount to anything more than interpreting a quantum particle as a wave? Because a chain of classical oscillators is just going to give you wave properies.
So oh, yes, yes. No, there is a relation, of course, between the excitation of these and, not completely. No, not completely. Because you have waves for the systems of classical oscillators, excitation, which are waves. But this will become back to the very time. So this will give the excitation of this classical system oscillators will be related to the properties of evolution of the quantum harmonic oscillator. So the fact that the eigen and the states of the quantum classical
harmonic oscillator, I describe by wave function, which bounds oscillators. We have waves which bounce from one wall to the other walls and propagate like that. So the wave function of the harmonic oscillator, the quantum harmonic oscillator, are not directly related to the excitation in space position of the oscillator, which would correspond to some properties of the excitation of the propagating in time of excitation. So there is a relation, but it's not there. The relation is not very complicated, but it's not that bad.
All my time. Okay, so I hope you have understood. I think you have got the idea. The idea is that a quantum system in real time, just a single quantum system with 1 degree of freedom, can be mapped by this operation into the properties of the classical system in one dimension, so with many degrees of freedom, but a classical. So you interchange the quantum properties of a system with 1 degree of freedom with the classical properties, the properties of a classical system with many degrees of freedom. Okay? Yes?
You've used a case for the harmonic oscillator to make this conclusion.
Yes.
How valid is it for other systems?
I will discuss that later when I will be discussing the relation between quantum field theory and quantum and classical statistical mechanics. The relation is not always very direct. There is always some relation, but you have to find it. What it is. Okay. So finally, one last remark, very important, that this h, you have factor 1 over h bar here. So if you want to view this as a partition function for a chain of oscillator, you have to identify h bar with the temperature, the classical system. So you have this very important mark. So you have one quantum harmonic oscillator, which is equivalent to a chain, a one-dimensional chain of coupled classical oscillators at finite temperature. And what is the temperature of this system is given by 1 over h bar. So in fact, what you have to identify is the h bar, the quantum oscillator, with the temperature of the classical system. Yes?
Sorry, I'm a little confused. Did you just replace the Euclidean action by the energy?
No, I rewrite the Euclidean action that I obtain as the energy of the system. So I made just this identification. I discretize the Euclidean action, and I remark, these terms can be considered as a classical energy for a chain of oscillator. It's just a mathematical identification.
We're integrating the energy over sigma, right? So how can we?
No, I have replaced the integral over sigma by a sum over I. The sum of the points along this chain, so that is discretized by.
And this epsilon doesn't show up in the analogy between h bar and temperature?
Well, you have an epsilon, so you see that the frequency of each oscillator is epsilon times n over 2 omega 0 squared. And you have the force, the strength of the coupling between neighboring oscillator is m
epsilons divided by epsilon squared. So there is, you know, the epsilon, as per the epsilon is the various coefficient of the energy function for this chain of oscillators. And I state just that I make the identification that h bar is analogous to one over the temperature. I can play different rules by this epsilon I'm pretty clear. But it's just a redefinition of what is the energy coefficient in the Hamiltonian and what is the temperature. So it's just a redefinition of renormality, a redefinition of how you normalize temperature. Either you normalize it in Kelvin degrees or in Fahrenheit degrees or in GV or whatever you want. That's the same. It's just a redefinition of the temperature. For this very simple system. But you have to remember that it's very important fact that the h bar, the Planck's constant for the quantum system, becomes, when you do this mapping, the temperature of the classical system.
Are you using the Boltzmann constant to be one or?
Yeah, I am using, you know, if you prefer, k constant. But the important relation is between h bar and t. Because the important relation is that in this classical system, this chain of oscillators, you have thermal fluctuations. Because it's a system at equilibrium. In the quantum system, which is what the harmonic oscillator, you have quantum fluctuation. You know that quantum systems have quantum fluctuations. And this mapping is the mapping between the quantum fluctuation of this system and the thermal fluctuation of the system. So there is a mathematical way
to describe the quantum fluctuation of the harmonic oscillator as the thermal fluctuation of a chain of classical oscillator. And there is a way to describe the thermal fluctuation of a chain of oscillators as the quantum fluctuation of a system with just 1 degree of freedom. So there is a, you can map the properties of an extended classical system into the quantum properties of much smaller quantum systems. And there is a mapping between the quantum fluctuations here and the thermal fluctuation here. And this mapping is very important. You have to keep it in mind. It's very useful to get some picture of what's going on often in a quantum system, viewing it as classical systems with thermal fluctuation. It's a mathematical equivalence, of course. It's not, well, generally, there is no relation between thermal fluctuation and quantum fluctuation in real systems with both finite temperature and quantum excitations, but it's very useful. Okay, so I think it took me some time, but it's very important to get the picture on this very, very simple system. So that's basically the simplest system in quantum mechanics is the harmonic oscillator. It's one of the simplest. You have the qubit, but in fact, the qubit is a bit more complicated. And when you are doing statistical mechanics, the simplest extended system is a chain of oscillators, basically, because it describes many, many systems. It describes excitation in crystals. It describes many systems. Okay, so now I will finish by discussing in these systems what are the observable. I've been doing a mapping just between the evolution operator and the partition function. But in general, knowing what is the evolution operator is not enough in quantum mechanics. You know, you need also to know what are the properties of the states. So you need to know what are the properties of the observables. So I will do that during the last quarter of an hour. So let us keep this picture and consider Okay, I think you remember what is the Euclidean action and the real-time action is, and now I am interested in. I will be interested in what is the quantum analogs of the, some expectation value of some observables. So, for instance, so I start from the classic. So I start from Euclidean time. Okay. And I am interested in what is what I will call the expectation value of Q at two different Euclidean time. Okay. What does it mean? It means simply that I integrate over all possible trajectory at Euclidean time, exponential minus 1 over h bar, the Euclidean action of q of sigma. And I compute with this weight the expectation value of the product of the position of the particle at time, Euclidean time sigma 1, and the position of the particle at times sigma 2. And to be in a good, I normalize that by the partition function of my system. Okay? So that's the definition of an expectation value. In statistical physics. It's a correlation, it's the expectation value of the product of two observables. So it's in fact what is called the correlation function. And I presume you have seen that in many details in lectures in statistical physics and in the lecture of Leo Kadan. So it's a correlation function between the degrees of freedom of the chain of oscillators at two different positions. You see? Okay? And, okay, so now let me I am considering this for the systems at equilibrium in a finite temperature for the harmonic oscillator. So, therefore, I will be considering is a system where let me represent this Euclidean time here. The Euclidean time here. Sigma is periodic with some period. So there is a periodicity with the analogy that tau over h bar is 1 over kBT, where T is the temperature of the quantum system. OK? And what it means simply is that I consider a sigma 1 point, a sigma 2 point, and I'm interested in computing this correlation function for this system viewed as a statistical system. Okay? And I want to understand what is the what this object corresponds to in the original quantum systems at imaginary time. Okay? So what is this? This is originally the denominator is just the trace of this is z over beta. Remember, this was z over beta. Therefore, this was the trace of exponential minus beta h in the original quantum system. Here I have a quantum system. Okay. So this is the sum over the sum of eigenstate times exponential minus beta times the energy of the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Okay. Now this is the this is now the same object where you compute the average with respect of q of sigma 1 and q of sigma 2. And now the question is what's happening when I want to. So I can compute this object. We will compute it next time easily. But I am interested in what's happening when this Q of sigma 1, I go back to real time. OK, so I can write this here or here. So I want to go back from Euclidean time to real time and to ask what is the subject, what is this, when I write a sigma 1 is I t1 and sigma 2 is I t2. So I go back in this direction. Okay, so here I have t1, and here I have t2. Okay. So now, then, what I have to do is simply to reconstruct what I computed in real time, starting from what I constructed in Euclidean time. And for this, you have to use a very simple fact, which is that the evolution operator, remember, the evolution operator, considered as a function of the time with value in the space of operators, is analytic. So it's exponential of t over I h bar h. So it's a function which is well defined in the lower half plane, but it's also an analytic function. Of time. It's an analytic function whose value is operator. So, but you may consider that each matrix element of this operator is an analytic function of time. Okay? And when you are computing, since it's an analytic function of time, it means that when you decompose your evolution operator as a product of evolution operator over small intervals of time, you can, in fact, you are allowed to do, instead of this, you are allowed to do something like that. Start from zero times, go to some complex time, then go to some other complex time, etc. So you are allowed to take a path integral in complex time, where time is neither purely real nor purely imaginary, but it can be a more complicated path in complex time. The only rule is that you are not allowed to deform your contour to go back, to go upwards, because u of t is defined only if time goes backwards. Time is not allowed to go upwards because then the evolution operator is not defined in the space of operators. So this is forbidden. Okay? So the question is, I start from a path integral in Euclidean time, and things like that. And when I arrive at time sigma 1, I measured the position of the particle. I continue the evolution in Euclidean time. And when I arrive at time sigma 2, I compute, I measure the position of the particle at time sigma 2. And I take the product of these two observations. And then I make the average of all the possible paths evolution of the system. So what I'm doing is that I start here, I evaluate, here I measure Q. Here I measure Q, and then I end up at the same time. Okay? And now I want to see what this happens when instead of measuring Q at this time, I measure Q at this time, which is real time, and I measure Q at this real time. So in order to do that, you have to use this trick. You can deform the contour, but simply be sure that you don't go upward in Euclidean time. So how do you do that? Of course, you can go there. You can deform your contour of integration to go there. Then you go there. Okay? And then you have to go back, to turn and to go back. So what you are doing is that you are doing that. So you deform your original contour, sigma 1 and sigma 2, which was this one on a cylinder. This is on a cylinder. This is on a cylinder. You start at real time, up to time t1, measure q, continue to evaluate, to go in real time. Let me finish my sentence and time t2. And then you go backward in real time and go evaluate and let the system evolve in imaginary time. Yes?
Yeah. Sorry. So what is this diagram?
This is the complex plane. So I start from the complex plane here. You see? I start from the complex plane and I consider, so this is time, this is tau. But I remember that I have to compute, to evaluate this expectation when the imaginary time is scheduled. So I have to take the complex plane and to roll it in order so that it becomes periodic in imaginary time. So this you can do very easily. Because imagine that this is the complex plane, this is real time, this is Euclidean time, and I want the system to be periodic in Euclidean time. That's very easy. You just roll it like that. And it becomes a cylinder. The cylinder is still infinite in real time, but now it's periodic in Euclidean time. So, when I am considering a quantum system at finite temperature, what I am really considering is a system defined in a complex time, which is infinite in the real direction, and which is periodic, so it's in fact a cylinder like that. So what I'm considering is that when my system evolves in imaginary time, it's both like it evolves like that. Go and answer at the initial time because imaginary time is carried. You see? And now so I have to deform this complex. So I start out from the system where the system evolves along this kind of time, and I want to deform it so that it passes through this one. So what I'm doing is that I deform this system like there, and there. You see? And that's what will give the expectation value of q of I t1, q of I t2. It will be given by this integral. But what is this integral? So this is 1 over z beta, and now let us interpret this pass interval in term operators. In term operator, I have a system which evolves from time 0 to times t1. So my system evolves like u of t1. This is the evolution operator for the quantum system. Then I measure q. So I apply the operator. I multiply this evolution operator by q. Then the system evolves from t1 to t2. So I have an evolution operator, t2 minus t1. Then I measure the position of the systems at times t2. So I multiply by the operator. These are operators. Okay. Then I go back in time. Because I want to go back here. So I apply the evolution operator, u of minus t2. Now I evolve along imaginary time. So I multiply by exponential minus beta h. Okay. And now I take the trace. So I start from a point here. Q, and I end up at the same position. I sum over Q, so I take the trace of this object. Okay? So when I go from imaginary time to real time, what I am computing is this object, the trace of these products of operators in the quantum system, divided by the trace of exponential minus beta h. Okay? Now, what is this object? You can rewrite this as the product of the two operators, q of 2 t at time t1 times q at times t2 in the Heisenberg picture. Okay? So this is the trace of exponential minus beta h times the product of two operators in the Heisenberg picture. And that's q of t1 times q of t2, because t1 was smaller than t2. If t1 is smaller than t2. If t2 would have been smaller than t1, what you would have measured is the product of q of t1, or the product of q of t2 by 2 of t1 if t2 is smaller than t1. You see? So what you are measuring is, in fact, what is called this object is called the time ordered product of those two operators. It's noted t of q of t1 and q of t2. Oh, I'm sorry, q of t2 times q of t1. Okay. So what you are measuring, what you are constructing via path integrals, when you are interested in correlation functions, are expectation value in the state at temperature beta of time order product of operator. You see? So what you are considering is, in fact, the trace of exponential minus beta h times this object. Okay, so this is, in fact, simply the trace of exponential minus beta h time order product of q of t2 times q of t1 divided by the trace of exponential minus beta h. So this is this object. Okay? And now, one last but very important remark. What does this becomes when the temperature goes to zero of the quantum system? And then I will finish. When the temperature, so let us write this here, because that's very important. When the temperature of the quantum systems goes to zero, okay, remember this relation. Temperature goes to zero means the period goes to infinity. This means that the period in Euclidean time goes to infinity. So you recover the complex plane, the full complex plane, and not the cylinder. Okay? So you recover the integral over infinite time. But then what's going on, what's happening in this product of trace of operator? Then this means that beta becomes, this means that the parameter beta becomes very large, because beta, this is beta. Whatever k be t goes to zero means beta goes to infinity. So when beta goes to infinity, all excited states in the trace gives very, very small contribution. And the only important contribution is the contribution of the ground state, of the lowest energy system of the state. So when beta goes to infinity, what you are doing is that you are projecting onto the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. The ground state is noted zero. So In that case, what you are getting is simply that the expectation value of Q of sigma 1, Q of sigma 2 at in Euclidean time, in Euclidean time, with no periodicity, with no period. The period becomes infinite. So in fact, you are integrating now from minus infinity to plus infinity in Euclidean time. What you recover by Vick rotation is simply the expectation value between the initial vacuum state and the, or the initial ground state and the final ground state of the time order product of Q of T2, Q of T1. Okay? So that's the second very important fact you must need about the relation between correlation function of the chain of oscillator. So the quantum analog of the correlation function in the chain of oscillators are the expectation value in the ground state on the systems of time order product of two operators, which here are the position operator. Okay. And this object, I think you have seen them probably in a slightly different context in David Tong's lecture. Those are called the propagator or Green functions of the quantum systems. Okay. And the fact that you are measuring between the ground state of the systems time order product of operators means that what you are computing in terms of propagator are what is called the Feynman propagator. So the path integral method constructs you the Feynman propagator of the quantum theory. And we will see that next time in more details when we're dealing with the scalar fields or quantum field theory instead of just the simple case of the harmonic oscillator. And I will end up there. I'm sorry for being a bit long. Yes?
What's the analogy in the quantum theory of taking beta going to infinity?
No, because
the beta, this is the beta in the quantum systems. Taking the temperature to zero in the quantum systems is, of course, projecting on the ground state, on the state of lowest energy. If you have no temperature, you have no excited state, so unless you work very hard, you can do that. But what you, the most easy things to get is just to compute expectation value observables on the ground state, on the value. So even if you want to excite the state of the energy of the system. So the way we are considering the system, we are considering the system at equilibrium. So you must be at finite temperature in order to reach the exact state.
Okay, I'm